Chapter 3. Every Man of Honor. Rob jerked awake in the bed, sitting up. "Father," he said into the air, and John sat up, reaching, even half asleep, for his blade, before he stopped and looked at him. "Are you all right?" Rob looked at him in the dark and said, without knowing how he knew, "Father's not coming north." And then he amended it. "He can't come. Something's stopping him." They sat in silence together, and then John said softly, "What are you going to do?" Rob looked at him, and then he smiled, because it was easy to answer, after all. "Whatever I have to," he said. John put his hand out to him, and Rob reached out and gripped it. "I'm with you to the end," John said. "You know that." "Yes," Rob said. "I know." They lay down and slept a little longer, and then they got up still in the dark. The day was already only 6 hours long. Rob went out and walked through the keep and spoke to the men and to the giants, who were hard at labor on the great defenses that had been long left unrepaired for lack of hands and time. He'd thought them more dim than men at first, but their labor was too quick and deft to go on thinking so, and he found that the more he spoke with them, the easier they were to understand. They spoke less in words than in silence, in the pressure of their eyes and the small shifting of their bodies. He'd asked them not to call him the King in the North, and he'd told them that his father lived, and also owed fealty to King Robert. "Where?" Meg had asked, wanting to know where they were then, and Rob said, "In King's Landing, in the south." And then Meg had looked at him steadily, and he'd said nothing more aloud. But what he'd meant was his father couldn't be the king in the north if he was in the south, and there had to be a king in the north now, and it had to be a Stark, so who else was there for it then? And Rob had felt too foolish to keep arguing further, as if he'd been trying to explain to a tree why it ought to care about dancing. The ravens began arriving from the south 4 days later, carrying the news he already knew, and more explanation with it. The rest of his bannermen and lords had already come to the wall. He gathered them together and shared the messages. "The Lannisters have turned the king's heart against my father," Rob said. "House Tyrell is sending us a fleet of ships loaded with grain, and King Robert has been persuaded to think we mean to use it to march south and invade. My father has been made prisoner in the Red Keep, and they offer the lordship of the North to any house that betrays mine. You'll have the offers soon, my lords, if not already." He kept his voice level while he spoke, although anger throbbed in his throat thinking of it. He remembers the Lannisters riding into Winterfell, shining and beautiful, and how quickly he'd learned that it was only fool's gold, skin deep. The Kingslayer taunting Jon, full of smiling disdain for the Night's Watch, for honor. The Queen smiling so at Sansa, as much to say she wished her no happier in her marriage than she had been. And they were the ones the king had chosen to heed instead of his father. It was a comfort when the great John spat off the side of the table, the answer the news deserved. "A posy of southern flowers who think we too wilt in the cold," he said, and low angry murmurs of agreement went around. "Aye," Rob said, "and King Robert will learn his mistakes soon, but not soon enough. We must make ready to stand against the Night's King with little hope of more help from the south. Lady Mormont," he turned to her, "the grain will come to Bear Island. Keep a quarter of the stores there for now, to guard against any disaster." She was nodding, and he detailed quickly how the rest of the grain would move through the north, to replenish the stores his lords had already sent, and supply the castles on the wall. And I'm sorry, my lords, but I must ask still more of you. I know you've already brought me all the men you could spare. Now I need you to summon the ones that you cannot, and leave your women to hold your keeps in their stead, with only men too young, too old, or too weak to hold a blade left behind. For if we can't stop them at the wall, we won't stop them at all. Some nodded at once, but many others looked uneasy, and Lord Bolton spoke for them. Lord Stark, he said, if you'll forgive me, we still haven't sighted the enemy. It's difficult to know how best to arrange our forces when we know so little of the opposition. Rob understood what Bolton truly meant, which was that he didn't want to leave his keep so weakened when the king was angry at the north and fearful and ready, perhaps, to march on them. And perhaps Bolton wanted to do it still less because he himself doubted what was coming. Rob didn't anymore. He knew it now, deeper than bone. Winter is coming. He'd said the words all his life, the way any man might say the words of his house, with pride, looking to them for meaning for his own life. But the words of House Stark weren't like the words of any other house, and he hadn't known until now what that meaning truly was, waiting under the ice slowly to be uncovered. A message, reminding them of the call that House Stark had to answer when it came. But he still had ordinary men to lead, and it would be no comfort to his men to save the world of the living if the cost were their homes and the lives of everyone they loved. That was why they would answer the call, to defend those things. You're not wrong, Lord Bolton, Rob said after a moment. Either to wonder what we face or to hesitate to strip your keep bare. I must ask it anyway. But I'll also send a party of volunteers, our men and wildlings together, to go into the far north as scouts to bring us more news of the Night's King. He looked across the table at John, who nodded back to him without a word, and said, And those of you who wish it shall send a trusted man of your own with them, he added, looking around the table. These doubts, he lifted the raven message, will hamper us badly enough. We can't afford still more among ourselves. He turned to Mormont. And I'd ask one more thing as well, Lord Commander, he said. The Night's Watch has the right to put out a direct call for aid, doesn't it? Aye, Mormont said, nodding. Then let it go out now, Rob said, to every house and keep and hold fast in all the Seven Kingdoms, any that we have a raven for. With this message, the Night's King rides, and the armies of the dead march upon the wall. All those who can must join the fight to hold them back for the realms of men. Let every man of honor stand forth and answer the call, and come north to join us, bringing what he can, whether he has a sword or only a strong back, armor or only courage, and supplies of any kind, from food and clothing to even knowledge. And may the gods look with favor and mercy upon us all.
You almost have to admire their persistence, Cersei said, tossing the raven message with all its grandiose language back onto the council table. Robert gazed down at it, too dark and sullen to call it a glare. There was a brittle look on his face. Oddly enough, wrath and betrayal agreed with him. He'd lost at least a stone in weight in the last 2 weeks. He'd stopped drinking entirely, and he'd been out in the yard with his warhammer twice a day. By the time the wildlings made it to Blackwater, he might even have become modestly dangerous again. Jaime wasn't feeling very warmly towards the message himself, either. Let every man of honor stand forth and answer the call. Exactly as if Robb Stark really was imagining himself a lord out of the Age of Heroes, calling up the mythical men of true honor that didn't really exist to come and help him fight a fairy tale war, when really he was just a brazen-faced traitor who didn't care that his own father was going to pay for it with his head. He wondered that the boy had the gall to dictate it. He flicked a hand towards the curling note. "And this message has gone out all over the Seven Kingdoms?"
"It seems so, my lord," Varys said. "I've had reports of it from nearly 24 holds already, and those are only the ones near enough for a raven to reach me so quickly."
"No one could possibly be stupid enough to believe this nonsense," Cersei said. Varys very noticeably didn't say anything. Cersei's mouth tightened.
"Could they?"
Varys hesitated, and then said,
"Again, I have only heard from the nearest holds, but it seems that some scattered few are finding the invitation a compelling one. Perhaps 12 men so far?"
"Well, I suppose when they get there and discover there aren't any monsters to fight, they'll turn around and come home again," Renly said with a snort.
"Except we're being stupid again," Cersei said, with a sudden hiss of breath. "Of course there will be monsters to fight."
Jaime jerked to stare at her with an odd lurching sensation, but it settled as she went on.
"It's the far north. Who knows what sorts of odd beasts they have up there? Robb Stark will dress up a few mammoths and mountain goats, put mummers on their backs, stage a heroic struggle for the men on the wall to see, then declare victory and march his forces south to punish those of us cowards who didn't answer his call to arms."
"A most creative idea," Varys says, with a faintly doubtful tone. "But if you will forgive me, your grace, Lord Eddard has never struck me as having such a fanciful bent of imagination."
"It's not him that's done it," Robert growled. "The whelp's the one behind all this, wanting to be king. Ned's only tried to protect him once he knew it'd gone too far for pardon."
They all nodded at once, along the table. It was the obvious explanation for it, really.
"That does sound like something a boy of, what is he, 17? Would come up with,"
Renly said. "I can't believe it's likely to be very successful."
"If they believe it, they're all heroes of the Great War," Cersei said. "If they don't, they're fools who marched across half the continent, straight into winter to be made fun of."
She looked over at Robert. "If we put a few dozen of those eager heroes to death for treason, perhaps it would dam the flow."
"If you will forgive me, your grace," Varys said, "I would suggest that you do the opposite. Let them go."
Jaime frowned at him. "You want us to let men join Robb Stark's army?"
"As I said, my lord, the departing are so few in number that I must believe they are insignificant from a military standpoint," Varys said. "Even a few thousand men gone north will not make a difference when he already has an army of 200,000. But that number is sufficiently large that they cannot all be closely screened. If you allow that trickle to run northwards, I can assure you that a broad tide of information will flow south in return. I might even be able to place a pair of ears directly in their council meetings."
"Any chance of more than ears?" Cersei said, after a moment, her eyes narrowing. "For instance, a blade?" Varys shrugged a little, opening his hands.
"I can't be certain, but it doesn't seem impossible."
That did seem worth letting a handful of enthusiasts go. Anyone who believed Stark's story enough to march north wouldn't be joining their own ranks anyway. Jaime glanced at Robert, who jerked his own nod as well.
"That aside," Jaime said, "the first order of business is going to be cutting off their supply. The second is deciding where to meet them. If we let them come to the Riverlands, it's going to be a mess. With their numbers, they can afford to spread out far more than we can. If we try for either the top or bottom of the neck, our own supply lines will be exposed to River Run, Fairmarket, Seaguard, the Twins, all held by House Tully and their vassals."
"What are the chances of persuading any of those lords to reconsider their positions?" Cersei said.
"Lord Frey is known to feel that his own house should be counted among the great," Varys said.
He's also possessed of a large number of hungry sons and daughters.
Cersei looked across the table at him, raising an eyebrow. Jaime nodded.
The twins would do nicely. They control the only Green Fork crossing that far north. We could land troops in both the Cape of Eagles and the Bight, move them across the river quickly to meet the Stark forces wherever we choose. We'd have the advantage of maneuverability, and we'll be close to Moat Cailin. If it looks vulnerable, we take it. And then it'll be as hard for them to come south as it is for any army to go north.
Then we'll send word to Lord Frey, Cersei said. Let him swear fealty to Robert directly. Support our forces, and he shall be Lord Paramount of the Riverlands. And one of his sons will have Riverrun, when we've taken it from the traitors of House Tully.
As for the supply, Renly put in, perhaps we should consider stopping it at the source.
He looked at Robert. I do realize you're very angry with Highgarden, but if the Tyrells could be persuaded to come back into the fold, that would cut off any more grain going to Robb Stark without having to spend so much as a man-at-arms or single ship to do it.
And they do have a most marriageable daughter, Varys put in.
Who's betrothed to that traitorous horse and dog in the north,
Robert growled.
It seems that's not so, Renly said. I've received word that Robb Stark has been promised to Lady Margaery, but only if she chooses to take him. She herself is free in honor to look elsewhere for a match, and Prince Joffrey now equally so.
Robert sat broodingly for a moment, then said,
See it done, then. But we'll not let the roses keep climbing on both sides of the fence. If they want the match, they'll bring the girl to King's Landing, and they'll be wed now, not in half a fucking year.
He pushed up to his feet and looked down at Jaime, brows heavy.
And start moving our men north.
He turned and strode away from the tables, and the rest of the small council rose and broke apart, eddying away into doors and corridors. In a moment, it was only Jaime and Cersei left. She was looking after Robert with a twist of her lip.
All these years, and it turns out that all he needed was to be cut loose from the fairy tale of Stark honor. It's a shame it took so long. He might have made a real king.
She turned back to him. I've had one more raven. Father sent 60,000 Lannister troops up the River Road. Uncle Kevin will take half of them to besiege Riverrun, and the rest of the forces will meet you on the King's Road going north.
Jaime nodded. She paused a moment and said abruptly, How bad is it going to be?
We'll know more once they're on the march towards us, Jaime said. He left the small council chamber to go back to the Tower of the Hand. But on impulse, he took the turning down to the Black Cells along the way. He didn't really know why. Stark had clung to his story this long. There wasn't any reason to think he'd change his tune at this point. But the message from the wall kept grating against the back of Jaime's head. Let every man of honor stand forth and answer the call. The sing-song rhythm of it stuck in his ears, repeating with the sound of his steps on the stone floors. He came down to the dark levels and frowned as he found the two guards standing almost right at the base of the steps, a long way off from Stark's cell. They both scrambled hastily to attention when he came down.
Is there some reason the two of you are guarding our extremely valuable prisoner from farther away than the length of a tourney field?
Jaime said sharply.
There's a draft, my lord, one of them said a bit timorously. The torches go out if you stand too close down there.
Then go get a lantern, Jaime said, even more sharply.
And the men both dropped their heads miserably, mumbling apologies.
As in, go now.
They vanished up the stairs in a hurry, and Jaime took one of the torches from the sconce in the wall and went down the corridor himself to Stark's cell.
He could and did blame the idiot guards, but he could also understand why they'd retreated. The dark felt oddly thick. The torchlight couldn't seem to make it even to the nearest wall, and all that it illuminated was the smallest square of stone at his feet. It was the fault of the draft, keeping the flame small and struggling. The cold on his face was a sharp contrast to the lingering autumn warmth up in the sunlit keep, as if winter was coming early down here. He lost track of the distance and jerked back with his heart pounding when Stark suddenly loomed out of the dark before him. He was standing in the mouth of his cell, his face and shoulders like carved granite. He didn't look especially worn down by his captivity. The iron chain was secure around his throat, but Jaime hadn't meant to get so close. "Lord Stark," he said, just barely managing to pull off what he thought sounded like an insouciant tone. "I thought I'd just look in on you and see how you were. Are the accommodations to your satisfaction? Enough water?" Stark just stared at him and said, "The call has come. Will you let me go and answer?" Jaime stared back at him. "What?" "The call has come," Stark said, as if Jaime were dim and needed it said more ponderously to understand it. "Will you let me go and answer?"
"Will I let... You can't be serious," Jaime said,
and when Stark just kept staring at him expectantly, he drew a sharp, enraged breath and snapped, "No, I will not!" And he didn't get a chance to finish telling Stark what a ridiculous idiot he was because Stark just turned and vanished back into the cell, the darkness swallowing him whole in a single gulp. Jaime almost went in after him to get more yelling in. But when he took a step, another blast of cold came in his face, and the torch sputtered so badly it nearly went out. He had to turn and shield the last few flickers among the wood with his body from the wind. And before he'd entirely decided to do it, he'd gone halfway back down the corridor. So that had to be what he'd meant to do, after all. It had been 3 weeks since John had ridden away beyond the wall, with a party of rangers and volunteers, to try and sight the Night's King. Half of Rob's bannermen had sent to their keeps for the men he'd asked for. He knew who had done it, because their men were coming in steadily. The other half were making excuses and saying that surely something had happened to their slow men. He didn't bother challenging them. He'd sent forth the call, and men of honor would answer it. The rest wouldn't, and there wasn't much to be done about that. And that morning, Jory rode in, with a company of men from the Riverlands. His great-uncle had come north with him, with the rest of the Tully Rangers.
"Catson River Run, with the children," the Blackfish told Rob. "We had word on the road that the Lannisters have besieged the castle, but they won't crack that nut anytime soon. There's a strong garrison and 3 years of provisions."
"If they can keep a siege that long, it'll mean we've stopped the Night's King here, and we'll have to be grateful for it," Rob said low. "Do you know anything more of what the King's forces are doing?"
The Blackfish snorted. "They're getting ready to meet you and your army in the neck. That old sow Frey is calling himself Lord Paramount of the Riverlands now. He's given them run of his lands."
He jerked his head towards the outside.
"I've brought you all the men of the Riverlands you're likely to get."
And then Jory told him, in tears, of father ordering him to go, and he drew out a bundle wrapped in cloth and handed it over.
"He told me to see it to you, my lord," he said, low and miserable. "If he couldn't bring it here himself."
Rob slowly reached out and took it. He knew what it was even before he opened the cloth and saw the Valyrian greatsword laying there. He stared down at ice with a tight clenching of sorrow and anger in his chest as Jory spoke of father standing alone in the courtyard, unarmed, for the sake of an oath made to a man who'd proved himself unworthy of it. If we see the end of this war, he said, raising his head to look Jory in the face, we will go south and take it back to him and shame that false king and every last one of those honorless cowards who measure the worth of a Stark's word by their own. Jory's face hardened with his, and he jerked his head in a nod of agreement. Rob longed to go south now. His father imprisoned in a black cell by the king, and his mother and sisters and Rickon under a Lannister siege. He wanted more than breath to take the men who now answered him and go punish them all for their treachery. But he couldn't. The Night's King was coming, and he had to be here to answer. Instead, he put the sword on his waist and went back to work. The work that he was the only one in the North to do. So Ice was at his side the next day when the men up on the wall raised the alarm. A single rider in the distance, all in black, glimpsed through the trees, riding towards them at top speed, and something following him. A thing that didn't move like any man or beast. Rob took a party of 20 men, wildlings and rangers, and rode out through the gates to meet them. Grey Wind took the lead, bounding over the snow in tremendous leaps, finding them a path over packed snow where the horses didn't fall through, until they were under the trees. They went quicker then, the horses trotting a steady pace, eating up the ground, until Grey Wind gave a huffing bark and went racing ahead to meet Ghost, appearing through the trees. John burst out only a few steps behind, bent low on the neck of a horse with its withers foamed in panicked sweat, on the edge of foundering, and he jerked his head up at the sight of them and yelled, "Watch the trees! Have someone looking up!" Rob looked at Jory, who nodded and fell back to the rear with his bow ready, watching the upper branches of the trees. And John let his poor horse stagger to a halt among them, jumping off and drawing his own Valyrian steel blade, the one Mormont had given him. Rob drew Ice as well and moved forward, scanning the trees ahead for any sign of movement. The wolves were pacing back and forth, growling low, their hackles raised, and then Ghost was leaping into the air, his head straining up and his whole body moving in an arc as if to follow something going above, giving a howling bark of alert, and without even seeing it himself, Rob swung Ice up and over his head just in time as a thing like a frozen waterfall came crashing down out of the trees over their heads. He smashed aside a spindly leg coming at him that looked like nothing more than an icicle. The heavy blade left a maze of cracks in its strange, near-translucent shell, but the creature had pierced the man across from him with another leg, impaling him through the chest and through the body of his horse. Neither made a sound. The man's arms were flung wide to either side of the piercing limb, and his eyes and mouth were staring open. In horror, Rob saw all the color leach out of their bodies, thin rivulets of red blood running out of them and traveling visibly up the long, stabbing arm. He couldn't spare more than a moment to look. Then he had to swing again as another leg shifted to try and stab down at him once more. John gave a yell and dove underneath to strike the ice spider from below, even as the other men began to club away at it with maces and stab with blades. "The joints!" Hegrin, one of the wildlings, a grizzled older man, was yelling. "Go over the joints!" Another of the wildlings squirted oil onto the thing's back and then put a torch to it, and its shell began making a cracking noise like thick ice breaking up in the spring thaw. Still beneath the spider, John managed to roll over towards what Rob belatedly realized was the head. John shoved his sword all the way through the neck and levered it out sideways to cut the head more than halfway off. The creature crumpled down, making a final high, shrill noise, and was still. He dragged himself out from under, and Rob pulled him up. They all stood, panting around it, wordless. Its body began clouding to dark blue as it lay there. It became more visible against the snowy ground. It didn't look like a spider so much afterwards.
There were a dozen limbs rather than eight, and it had a long body, more like a caterpillar, which had been nearly translucent. But it had moved like a spider, scuttling and stabbing. Hegrun spat into the snow, looking down at it. "We did for the last of the foul bloodsuckers in our lands a long time ago," he said. "And none of them were ever this big. This one's come from Always Winter, some buried place up there." Rob nodded grimly. "We'll haul it back to Castle Black for the archivists to look at," he said, and looked at John. "The rest of the men?" John shook his head, bleak with sorrow. "I don't know," he said. "They gave me 3 of the horses to get back to you, with word as quick as I could. I was halfway back when the ice spider got one of the horses. It would have been me, too, that time, if it weren't for Ghost." He put his hand on Ghost's head as the wolf trotted over to him. "I've just barely stayed ahead of it ever since. I don't know if it got the others first or if it came past them to stop me." "And what was the word they sent you to bring?" Rob said. "Did you sight the Night King's army?" John paused and then nodded a little. "They're in the Valley of the Milkwater," he said. There's a line. The furthest place any part of the sunlight hits for any part of the day. And they're standing right up to that line all across the valley. And when the sun came up on the morning, we saw them. The line had gone a little further south. And the whole army moved up to it." Rob drew a breath and let it out. He'd known they were coming. And when? Now he understood why. The giants could tell him, exact to the day, when the dead would come. The Night's King wasn't waiting to march until the long night came. He didn't need to. His army didn't need to be fed or to sleep. He would simply come until he reached them, a few steps every day, chasing the sun down into the dark. "How many of them?" he asked. John's face told him everything he needed to know, even before he spoke. He shut his eyes for a moment, his face drawn almost as if in pain. "The whole valley was full of them," he said, very soft. "It made the wildling army look small. We couldn't even make sense of it to count. A million, maybe more?" And John didn't say what Rob knew he'd thought. Seeing that mess of dead men coming, what every man around them, falling silent, thought at the same time. "Too many."
The same stupid line from Rob Stark's message kept sticking itself back into Jamie's head. "Let every man of honor stand forth and answer the call." The insistent power of it was so strong that one day he'd realized he'd written it down into the margins of the grotesquely tedious report about the logistics of grain supply to the Riverlands. He'd handed off all his sentry duties to the other Kingsguard, but there still weren't enough hours in the day to plow through the sheer mountains of paper, his new and never-ending battle. The words in the margin felt like a pointed message that he was losing that battle. He glared at the words in fury and then got up and went for reinforcements. But when he came to Tyrion's room, he had to stop on the threshold, partly for surprise and partly because he couldn't have made it inside without knocking something over. The entire place was crammed with books. Books on every shelf and table, books in teetering stacks on the floor. The rest of the floor was occupied with 4 chests also filled with books. "What are you doing?" he said, bewildered. Tyrion gave a small, guilty jerk as he looked up from his chair in the midst of the stacks. He was reading yet another book, and looked around his own room, and said, "Ah," as if he'd been half expecting to be caught out. And now it had finally happened. Jaime stared at him. "What are all these?" Tyrion hesitated, then shrugged and said, "Everything that the maesters at the capital could find me about the Great War and the Long Night.
It's mostly nonsense and fairy tales, of course, but I'm picking out a few points of commonality and a few of the texts that seem to be worth investigating. He gestured to the chests. Please tell me you're joking, Jamie said, his shoulders tightening with anger. What in all the seven hells? Tyrion paused for a long moment and then looked up at him with a frown. Jamie, I haven't said anything because there wasn't a point to saying anything, but you must realize we have a problem here.
Yes, Jamie said. We're about to be invaded by 200,000 fucking wildlings under the command of the North.
That's only a possible explanation for the facts. For the set of facts we have, Tyrion said. The other explanation, courtesy of the Starks, is that there is a giant army of dead men coming to kill us all. Your explanation has the advantage of being much more plausible. Do you think so? Jaime said, sharp with sarcasm. Tyrion only gave him a mildly exasperated look.
It's also got the major disadvantage of not actually matching the facts we have. The most significant of them being, where is Stark?
What? Jaime said with a small jerk, wondering, had Eddard got out? Had he somehow persuaded someone to let me go to answer the call?
Where is Robb Stark?
Tyrion said, and Jaime just barely controlled his flinch of relief.
That is a fact that we have. I've been confirming it on an almost daily basis with Varys. Robb Stark is at the wall.
What is he doing? We know that too. He's fortifying the long-abandoned castles of the Night's Watch and shipping his newly acquired grain to all of them. None of that makes any sense whatsoever if he's about to march south to invade us. Unfortunately, it would make excellent sense if his explanation were true.
He's going to stage a false attack.
Yes, yes, I know about Cersei's very imaginative idea. It's nonsense. Playing a childish prank on 200,000 men with a handful of beasts and mummers and hoping it'll work? Even if he were planning to do that, most of that grain would still be going to Winterfell. Stuffing a bunch of castles at the wall with enough grain for 6 months literally makes no sense, except if he's planning to be there for 6 months.
Then the wildlings are useless and he needs to drill them for 6 months to make an army,
Jaime said, almost a snarl.
Find another explanation if you don't like a detail or two of ours, but this,
he waved a furious arm over the stacks.
Look me in the face and tell me you seriously believe there's an army of dead men coming for us.
He waited for it, almost with held breath, but Tyrion frowned down at his book instead.
I'm not telling you that, he said. I'm telling you that we don't know what's going on up there, and meanwhile you're making a lot of moves as if you do.
He gestured around the books all over.
And I've found 8 different records from different people writing in different eras, all of them talking about something very unusual that happened in the North at the start of a very bad winter, after a very long summer. The Stark line is explicitly mentioned in 7 of those records. None of them go into a lot of detail, but there's a single couplet that keeps appearing over and over, either in whole or in part. In variations, the words change as the language changes, but the meaning stays the same.
And what is it? Jaime said, coolly, although his stomach was churning unpleasantly. He didn't want Tyrion to say it. He didn't want to hear the words out loud again. Let every man of honor stand forth and answer the call.
But Tyrion reached out and picked up one of the other books, in arm's reach, that was lying open to a page marked with a ribbon, and he read aloud.
When the Night's King rides, the king in the North must answer. The king in the North, whose name is Stark.
Wonderful, Jaime said, folding his arms over his chest. He wasn't any happier with that one, either.
You found your fairy tale. That gave them the idea.
Tyrion sighed visibly, and Jaime ground his teeth.
What's your point?
What good is any of this research of yours going to do us? We don't need mythical ways to kill dead men that don't exist. You don't, Tyrion said. But Robb Stark still at least claims that he does, and he explicitly said that any man of honor should come north to answer the call. Jaime jerked a little and glared at him, irritated by the surprise. But Tyrion was already sailing onwards, bringing what he could, even knowledge. Jaime threw up his hands. So what, you're planning to go north? He said cuttingly, toting a few dozen books along. I'm leaving in the morning. Jaime just gaped at him. He had no idea what to say or do. He wanted to howl in rage. He wanted to pick Tyrion up and shake him. And he wanted to... Someone's got to, Tyrion said, as if answering whatever it was that Jaime hadn't said or done yet. Jaime, is there anyone? Anyone at the wall right now, in Varys's pay or ours, a single lord or officer, who could send you a raven saying, shit, there's really an army of dead men, and you would believe them? No, Jaime snarled. Right, and that's why I've got to go, Tyrion said. So if I get there and it turns out that Robb Stark and his army of half-feral wildlings really are the only thing standing between all of us and something truly horrible, I can yell at the top of my lungs for you to come and help save the world before it's too late. Because if I do, you'll believe me. They'll put a knife to your throat and make you write whatever they want, Jaime said. Tyrion waved it away. If I send you a letter and it starts with the word shit, it's all true. Otherwise, it's all lies. Then they'll trick you, Jaime said. Don't be an idiot. I'm starting to think you're being one, Tyrion snapped back. Jaime, the wall isn't a myth. Jaime stared at him. I have personally pissed off the top of it with my very own cock. Someone built it. Do you think they did it for fun? Let's build a massive ice wall 1,000 miles long. We don't have anything better to do with our time. They built it to keep something in the north, something that they expected to try to come south again someday. It would be stupid for us to take Robb Stark's word that there's an army of the dead coming that even he doesn't claim to have actually sighted. But it is just as stupid to absolutely refuse to believe that anything strange and dangerous is happening up there at all. And I'll give you my word, if I write to you, it'll be because I have seen the army of the dead, or something just as bad, with my very own eyes. And when I do, that is when you should stop insisting it's all lies and come help. Jaime had to storm away without another word, because otherwise, he still didn't know what he would have done. But it would have been something extreme, and likely stupid. He spent the rest of the day seething and woke up the same way the next morning and went to go yell at Tyrion some more, only to find that he had already gone. Jaime had to storm all the way out of the keep, and he only just caught him in the square just inside the King's Gate, where a little caravan of fools was assembling so they could make the journey in the company of like-minded idiots. I need you here, Jaime said tightly, standing by the modest little mule cart that Tyrion evidently meant to ride all the way to the wall. The chests were being put on it. Don't be a fool. Tyrion sighed, turning away from the loading process. You don't need me, he said. Varys can find you a clerk to do your paperwork. You know perfectly well that Cersei doesn't want to use me for anything more important, and you aren't going to fight her over it. That makes this the most useful thing I can do for our family. You really are going north, a voice said. Joffrey's voice. And Jaime looked round. All three of the children had come out of the keep on his heels, with the Hound and a few other Kingsguard shepherding them. Myrcella and Tommen had woebegone faces, but Joffrey, behind them, was only alight with mocking glee. I almost didn't believe Myrcella. Tyrion eyed Joffrey and didn't respond, but he held his arms out to Myrcella and Tommen, who ran to hug him. When I get back, I expect you both to have grown at least half a foot, he said to them sternly. Make sure you work on that. They made plaintive promises and farewells. Good luck, uncle, Joffrey added smirkingly. I'm sure you'll be of great service against the legions of the dead.
Tyrion just turned and looked up at Jaime. I hope this isn't goodbye, but just in case. Jaime gritted his teeth and then knelt down and hugged Tyrion hard, something tight and painful in his throat. Don't get yourself killed, he said. And if they do try to make you write something, I'll make sure to close it by sending my love to my oldest nephew, Tyrion said dryly. One of the others came over, a tall man in mismatched armor with a thatch of blonde hair who was a woman, actually. She said, Are you ready, Lord Tyrion? I am, Tyrion said, and smiled up at Jaime once more, a little wavering, and went to get up onto the cart. Jaime stared at the woman incredulously. You must be joking, he said. Why are you going? She glanced at him with cold glitter in her eyes. The message said, Let every man of honor stand forth and answer the call. Jaime barely managed not to twitch or to slap her, which was what he desperately wanted to do. And what that means is they need all the help they can get, so I won't wait to be invited by name. Then she looked him up and down, her eyes distinctly traveling the length of his sword before they came up to look him hard in the face. What are you waiting for? She turned on her heel and marched away to her horse at the head of the caravan. The caravan as mismatched as her armor. A couple of other hedge knights, men he vaguely recognized from the second or third ranks of the tourney circuit. One of the Kingswood huntsmen with his bow and two quivers of arrows and a boar spear. Some men who looked like uneasy farmers, going on foot with no armor and no weapons at all but pitchforks. An older boy, Joffrey's age, carrying a smith's hammer over his shoulder and an absurd-looking helm shaped just like a bull's head. Two city men with knives who looked exactly like low pickpockets. And a small mule cart carrying his brother, his little brother, and his four chests of books, and a round-faced squire anxiously making sure they'd all been secured properly. Jaime still couldn't believe it was happening, even as Tyrion gave the mule a slap of the reins and the whole cavalcade lurched into motion, rolling away towards the gates, going north. The woman rode out first with the two knights, disappearing through them. The first men on foot were out past the wall. The cart was almost at the gates. And next to Jaime, the hound said abruptly, Ah, oh, fuck it, and walked right past him and went after them. Joffrey jerked his head incredulously, following him with a wide stare. What are you doing? He said, and then shouted, Stop, dog, I command you to stop. Fuck off, the hound said over his shoulder, without so much as a glance, and kept right on going. His long strides caught up to the mule cart, even as it went trundling through the gate, and he grabbed the side of it and heaved himself up onto the driver's seat next to Tyrion, who just slid over and gave him the reins. Joffrey was gaping after them, his whole face and mouth open in outrage. And Jaime felt the way he looked, a wild fury of roaring buried in his chest, a hunger bound up behind iron bars that desperately wanted to burst out. And he clenched his fists hard enough to make his hands hurt, holding it in. For a moment, it almost slipped free, and then he jerked himself around to face the Red Keep again, with a hard, wrenching sensation. He forced himself onto the stairs back up. It got easier after the first few. But even as he climbed, with the children and the rest of the Kingsguard trailing behind him, he knew that he was waiting now. He was waiting for Tyrion to send him a letter from the north that said, Shit, come now. And if it came, he'd be on a horse and gone the next morning, no matter what else stood in the way.